Now here we go.
Most people really don't believe me. I know that. I live with that every day of my life. I've been pretty well tuned out by the media. If anything is remembered of me, I guess in the general world, what they remember is, haha, rectal probe, or he's a disturbed man, he's crazy, or something like that. But the truth is, I am not crazy. This is about emotions and feelings more powerful than human beings experience. It's about living and facing such experiences, and it is hard. It is real hard.
Bad things have happened to people from my childhood who I returned to meet again. I think I was traumatized in early childhood, and I don't think I'm real alone. I think the whole neighborhood was bruised as if an invisible fist had come.
And also, I want to go home.
I don't think that I did it. I don't know what I did exactly connected with this in terms of intelligence work.
I can't get that face out of my head.
Apparently nothing. I can't remember anything at all. Not even a snatch of anything.
Really?
You will not live if you join the CIA. But I am a very conventional person. I was not able to control what happened. As you're undoubtedly aware, there's a whole school of thought in our world that they're evil. And they wouldn't disagree with that for a minute. Dark side and evil are complicated issues. We make the dark side evil by the way we deal with it, and the grays will test you and test you and test you. The more you work with the dark side, the more successful you are, the darker they get. Until you find the only thing is surrender.
Because I cannot do a thing about this. I don't even want to look up at this.
The only thing is surrender.
Can we help you stop screaming? Can we help you stop screaming?
Hello there.
Whoa.
I was just going to try an experiment.
Phil, you there? Can you hear me? I can.
Okay. Can you hear yourself?
I am not getting any reverb.
Keith? You sound like you're underwater.
Maybe he is.
Yeah. I'm in the pool.
Is everybody still here? Are you, Phil?
Yes.
Still there?
I am here.
I was actually just curious if there was anything that Phil disagreed with in this piece, if there's anything that jumped out of him as just sort of obviously wrong. Or...
Well, Phil pretty much disagrees with everything.
In principle.
In principle, yes. If it exists, I disagree with it. I'm against it.
What do you got?
So I have to fight it and everything. Well, I can't really put it into words right now. A lot of it was just, you know, me constantly questioning and stopping. Okay, how do you know this? You know, who says that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, because I read your notes, and yeah. My response to that was that, or is that, it doesn't really matter how somebody knows something. If they really know what they're talking about, that communicates. Mm-hmm. So then if I feel that somebody knows what they're talking about, I don't care. Yeah. Like, I don't have that reaction. Well, yeah. I say I don't have that reaction. You have, but maybe you're having that reaction because you feel that they don't know what they're talking about. I don't know.
No, it's just my way. It's my way to resist and reject to start off, and slowly I'll eventually accept, but I have to have that resistant sort of relationship, because I will not just accept the authority, and it probably goes back again to the erratic, insane, tyrannical father. You know, I'm not going to swallow everything you say. I'm going to fight you all night until we find one little thing that I can accept, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, it is a natural defense, and I think it has its uses. Like, the intellect is there to sort the seeds, but if it's overworked, then you don't get to enjoy the show. It's like if you're watching a movie and you're just constantly looking for discontinuities and whatnot.
You're
not going to get swept away, right?
Yeah. And when it comes right down to it, if I just feel I'm accepting too much, then I will fight just to fight.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is because I read it again last night thoroughly and slowly. And my opinion of this chapter, at least, is that it's unassailable. I mean, if there are any problems with it, I would love to hear it.
There you go, Phil.
Yeah. Well, that's something I'd have to think about and work on later. I'll try to. Yeah. I mean, I might still have some legitimate, not merely a defensive, self-protective maneuver disputes with some of this. I'd have to think about it and, you know, limit it to the things that are actually valid, because I realize that a lot of my resistance to things is not valid the whole time, and eventually I'll give in, but maybe not to all of it. But yeah, I'll struggle through it and see if anything else remains, and then maybe I'll address it in an email, but I couldn't really put it into words right now.
Was there anything that caused confusion that you didn't understand?
Oh, everything the first time I read it. after the second or third time, yeah, I kind of got into it. You know, I like much of it, of course, is, well, maybe not of course, but I said of course, so let's say of course, is familiar to me, I think. The inner guardian, you know, self-protective figure, all that kind of, you know, stuff, so on. I mean, that's familiar to me. You know, I made the tyrannical father connection, you know, pretty much on the first or second page, and, you know, all that. So, yeah, I mean, I can't remember what I was saying. What was the question? What did you say?
Was there anything that confused you?
Confused. Oh. Not really, I don't think. Nothing that stands out right now that I can think of off the top of my head. I mean, it was, you know, relatively, I could understand what was being said intuitively pretty much. And I can't think of anything that I'm still.
I think, like, a full understanding of it, A, is not possible because of the nature of the beast. And B, it is not desirable either. Like, I think as long as it raises enough questions and creates enough sort of aha moments.
That's the only thing I have, but you have to ask yourself, why would a child's immune system shut down? It was something designed to frighten us. I think I was traumatized in early childhood, and I don't think we're alone.
Yeah, it is a difficult one to kind of grasp as a practical reality, because you're talking about the psyche, what shape is it, what does it look like, how does it work, we don't know any of this. Religion talks about the soul, and that's equally amorphous, but it's kind of meant to be. You just say, well, the soul is off in heaven, and that's where it's going, and it's kind of, you're not supposed to know too much about the soul, whereas the psyche, obviously, psychology is the exploration of the psyche. So it is attempting to map that reality, but it's not a physical reality. It has effects on the physical, but it transcends the physical. So this particular model, and how it is that victims of trauma become self-traumatizing machines, almost like compulsive addicts of trauma, there's various different ways to describe that, and I think that's because, and they're probably all metaphors, and I think that's because that we are in the land of metaphor. As soon as you're talking about the psyche, you're in the realm of metaphor. You can't talk about it directly. And I think it's one of the obstacles, I feel like, when we're talking now, but also with the written piece, I feel like there's a sort of built-in obstacle to understanding, which I've tried to remove, or at least, get over it every time by... not by any one method, except by fully understanding it myself and then writing it down. So when I'm incorporating the ideas of Kalshid or Norman Brown or Freud or Bataille, whoever, that's been what has been happening. Like I've written down quotes and I've paraphrased, but I still haven't quite got it, and so then I've gone back, and then I keep returning until it's kind of assimilated. And talking about, of course, is an even bigger challenge to that, right? Because I think that this is what communicates. Like, if somebody really understands what they're talking about, it's much easier to understand them. That sounds like kind of obvious, but I mean that two people could use the same exact words and phrases, and one understands and the other doesn't, and you would understand much more easily the person who understands.
So that's my problem.
if someone
understands what they're talking about, it's easier to understand them. So yeah, that's usually my problem, trying to, at the same time as I'm expressing my viewpoint, trying to figure out what the hell is my viewpoint. I can't understand what I'm saying. I just keep saying it until something makes sense.
Right. Well, then, see, what I have tried to do with this piece is, then I'll talk about my attempt to understand this.
Yes.
So you're still talking about it, but you're not trying to force it into meaning, because that's what makes it incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm. Forcing into meaning, yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think, like, a full understanding of it, A, is not possible, because of the nature of the beast, and B, it is not desirable either. Like, I think as long as it raises enough questions and creates enough sort of aha moments, the endeavor here seems to be to kind of introduce psychology into the alien UFO paradigm.
Yep.
To incorporate it in that. So that in itself is creating a new paradigm. I mean, the potential there, the endeavor is to create a new paradigm. And this would be part of what this whole project's about, which is that these beliefs are being actually shaped towards social, political ends. So it's paramount that they not be undermined or subverted, that they not be challenged, and that new elements not be allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't require a conspiracy, although there is one if you want one, but because it's, again, we touched on this last week, that it's so difficult for individuals and collectively to allow something to be unknown and unresolved. So I think, presenting people with a mystery, which is actually, it was an unresolvable mystery, except by going all the way inward into one's own psyche and one's own history and finding one's own individual resolution to it. But by actually just looking outward at all the clues and all the evidence, it will never be resolved, let's say. If you present people with that, and then you just leave these trail of breadcrumbs that appear to be leading to a mystery, people will eat them up, and they will gratefully, I guess, adopt a belief system that is full of holes, because at least it allows them to, you know, relieve that tension of not knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I tend to look at ufology in the same way that I look at conspiracies, as I said, like a symbolically, and that the looking at them is never going to lead to any conclusions about the phenomenon, but rather the observer. That we can learn, we will never learn anything solid about the thing itself, but we can learn about ourselves through the observation.
Yeah. And in the case of ufology, it may be that it seems, if there is this genuine non-human element, even non-physical element, that may even be part of, or even the primary goal of that agency, is to bring us to some sort of self-realization as individuals.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because that's how Strieber initially describes his experiences, and that's what this piece is about, is actually sifting through all of his own interpretations that have actually obscured what seems to be the fundamental nature of it, which was that he was undergoing psychotherapy from aliens, quote-unquote, from non-human, non-physical, who knows what kind of imaginal, psychic, demonic beings.
Mm-hmm.
His own psyche, really. He was interacting. Somehow his psyche abducted him and led him through these, with the collaboration of, you know, human agencies. It gets very complicated here because the psyche is everywhere and nowhere. But yeah, that he was describing a kind of theater, a kind of therapeutic theater that he was subjected to,
mm-hmm.
which has nothing to do with extraterrestrials or global this or global that. It's all about him.
Yeah. But I guess that's the one thing he sort of refuses to take seriously.
Well, I think, again, it's that either-or thing, so it's really hard to allow that model to sort of to introduce that concept without it then being taken for, they're all in your mind, really.
Right.
No, they're not in your mind, they're in your psyche, and you are in your psyche, too. Because that's a whole different paradigm. Like, psychology has been attempting to introduce the paradigm of the externalized psyche, which is kind of like the old animistic view of the world, but it hasn't succeeded because psychology has become an industry. And a science, you know, exclusively a science. Not exclusively, obviously, there's practitioners who are still attempting to to do it creatively, but as it is, basically psychology is just one more branch of, you know, consensus reality. It hasn't caused a revolution in perception.
But Yeah, I can see how someone like Whitley would feel threatened by any kind of psychological interpretation, because it would be then taking away from the physical reality. But as you're saying, right? The two are not mutually exclusive.
No, and that's just interesting, because Jung, you know, his groundbreaking book Flying Saucers, it seems like I'm sure if he was around today, he would be fascinated by alien abduction and probably be doing the same kind of exploration that he did with UFOs themselves. And he had to admit in the end that they were physically real, even though he didn't want to. Like, he'd come up with a very complete sort of model for them as psychic projections. And he didn't abandon that model, he just had to add a footnote to it, but they do appear to be physically real also.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and to me, I guess, because I haven't had an experience, an encounter experience or an abduction experience, I don't have an attachment to that physical aspect. So, to me, the literal physical reality is kind of, well, it's not essential. But for someone who had that, I can see easily how they'd be very attached to that idea and cling to it desperately.
Mm-hmm. And in Whitley's case, it's specifically the fact that he was raped, really, that the implant in his ear and the permanent damage that was done to him through being raped, as he calls it, those are the primary elements of that this is physically real.
And I learned something recently that apparently, according to Whitley, the object that was used to rape him was apparently he understands the nature of that instrument, that it...
Yeah, I know, because I didn't think that he had commented on it when I found out that it's actually... Phil won't know this, because he hasn't... Yeah, you know that he... You know the rectal probe, everybody knows that about Strieber, right?
You bet.
So, somewhere along the way, working on this piece, I discovered that it's something that's been used for impotent men to help them, you know, inseminate since 1948. It's a rectal probe that electrocutes, uses electricity to cause the male to ejaculate.
It stimulates the I forgot what it's called, but yeah, but I think it's mostly used in animal husbandry.
It's now it's used on bulls and stuff, but at least what I found on it was, yeah, since 1948, it's kind of a significant year, it was being used with human beings. So Strieber had this experience in 1985. He didn't actually write anywhere in any of the books about this, the possibility that that probe might have been used to make him ejaculate, even though he does refer to the fact that there was a sexual element, and even that he thinks he took their semen on that night, but he never joins those two dots in any of his written work. But there is an audio that I found recently in which he says, I think this is what it was, and he describes that technology. He doesn't mention the fact that it's very old technology, and he doesn't raise the very obvious question of why these beings who are able to enter into the very depths of his psyche and manipulate or, you know, influence his feelings and his thoughts, and, you know, they seem to have almost total power over him in every way, why they would have to use this archaic technology in order to get him to ejaculate.
Huh.
Or why they would be doing that anyway.
Well, in terms of getting his semen, I mean, that's...
Oh, okay. All right.
Sort of a separate thing, isn't it?
I see.
that's less of an anomaly, because that's part of the sort of larger alien narrative, isn't it? The hybrid agenda.
Mm.
But that does seem like a very obvious, not to get sidetracked on the nuts and bolts and things, but
I mean, literally.
It's, it is, I think it's a sort of compelling example of this overlap between the physical and the psychic, let's say, or the imaginal, and the alien, quote-unquote, and the human agendas. Because if something happened to Strebe on that night in 85 that did involve non-human beings, whether they're demonic or angelic or demonic or whatever they are, but it also included a rectal probe that caused physical damage, permanent physical damage, that was the proof of the experience for him and that caused those memories to surface. They don't seem to be the same agencies, in my opinion. It would seem that we're talking about two agencies. One that's absolutely physical and presumably totally human, all too human, and the other which is not really that physical at all. But we'll say it's real, we'll allow that it's real.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you read that Greenbaum speech that I sent you in full, but he talks about this is a psychiatrist, a doctor, a PhD, who's been studying victims of ritual abuse, and one of the things that he talks about is how commonly the individual has a electrode, well, in this case, I think it was a girl, like, put in her vagina. And electroshock is sent there. So,
for what purpose?
As part of the conditioning or, you know, mind control technique.
No, I didn't know that.
Yep. Well, that's a possible connection there.
Yeah, well, there's something there, I mean, very fundamental, I think, about this bodily intrusion, bodily penetration. Because actually, even the implant is that. Well, there are three things. One that Strebe describes before the rectal probe having a needle stuck into his brain. So that's the penetration. And then there's the probe, very obvious penetration, and then there's the implant later on, but which is also, you know, an object that's penetrating his body. So I think there's something archetypal about that. There's something just very fundamental there, that something becomes absolutely real to us at the point it actually breaks that barrier of our skin. And if you think about it, Freud's definition of the ego is that it's a projected image of the surface of the body. I know it's not an exact quote, but that the ego is kind of founded on
an outgrowth
of, like, a psychic outgrowth of the surface of the body, which is, we can see that today and experience it as how much of our sense of self it comes from our self-image. Because, we experience that. If you think about how we experience ourselves, or how an infant would experience itself totally, but how we do to some extent as an individual, it's the, besides, you know, seeing isn't an experience, that we could be, you know, a camera or whatever, but actually the sensation of the surface of our bodies, that's kind of our sense of self right there, isn't it? And then if you add to that, when we look in the mirror, which of course is, you know, there's a moment when an infant first looks in the mirror, but there's a period before it ever sees itself, and there's even a period when, like most animals, it won't recognize itself in the mirror. Yeah, it's, at a certain point we develop a self-image, and that remains constant. Like, we can be walking down the street, we're not seeing ourselves, but we are imagining how we look.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's internal image, and that internal image is kind of as things that, like an outer body, an astral body. It's inviolate. Like, nobody can touch that image. So the whole media, mass media, can totally get its sticky hands all over it, but in terms of an actual penetration, it doesn't even exist, so it can't be touched.
Hmm.
Okay. Now here we go. There's a whole school of thought in our world that they're evil. And they wouldn't disagree with that for a minute. And the Greys will test you and test you and test you. Will test you and test you and test you.
Like, what makes the difference between a writer who has, or an individual who has strange ideas and strange experiences, writes a book about it and nobody has heard of them 10, 20 years later, and one who becomes like Hubbard? Like, the assumption, the common assumption is that it's kind of random. And it's just luck of the draw or originality of ideas. But the alternative interpretation is that certain individuals and certain models, let's say, are either created and then promoted, or sought out, discovered and promoted, so that they will become hugely influential.
And the promotion is not always so direct. It can even come in the form of criticism, or putting the person down to a degree, but one that allows for them to still have some leg to stand on.
Yeah, it's definitely more subtle and complex than simply making sure that they have bestsellers, because for something to become mimetic, to become viral, there has to be an element of controversy, I think, or at least an element of controversy is extremely helpful to that. And so, like, I was reading about the Roswell thing recently, and here's the thing with Roswell. Now, initially, they said, oh, we found a flying saucer, or whatever, and then they said, oh, no, it's just a weather balloon. So, if all of that was part of an agenda to spread the meme of alien bodies, etc., etc., it makes sense that they would do it that way, because that creates that controversy and that tension. If they'd simply just released the information and said, we've found alien bodies, well, obviously that's a lot harder. If it's a hoax, that's a lot harder to actually make it convincing, because then you can't do it that way. But if they simply cover it up, then nothing comes out. So to do it both, to actually release it and then cover it up, that makes it more convincing, and it also makes it more compelling, because it's like we were talking about last week, what's most compelling about this whole mystery is that there doesn't appear to be a solution to it, that you can see it one way and that seems, oh yeah, that's the way it is, but then you can look at it a completely different way and say, oh, wait a minute, no, that's the way it is. And then you go back and forth and back and forth, and that kind of generates this momentum, I think, because you just keep giving energy to it. Mm-hmm. So I think that when agendas and individuals and philosophies and whatnot are promoted or chosen in order to be influential, it's also part of it is to suppress them.
Yeah.
Paradoxically.
Right, which sort of legitimizes them.
Yeah. Right. Because he sells. This must be true because the government is trying to suppress it.
Yeah, why, what interest would they have otherwise?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know what to say about that.
It does kind of leave you not knowing what to think.
Yeah.
But you can't ignore it. Because it's the whole conspiracy thing, like the first website I ever had, so I first was made contact with Phil, paranoid awareness thing, was there is a worldwide conspiracy to create the illusion that there is a worldwide conspiracy.
Yeah.
And that's still what it comes back to for me.
Mm-hmm.
That paradox.
Yeah, that most conspiracies are themselves the result, the product of a conspiracy.
So there is no conspiracy. Wait, but there is.
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. Well, see, my biggest problem with the conspiracy, well, not my biggest, one of my biggest problems with conspiracies, and, you know, they're very entertaining, first of all, is that the more I would read about conspiracies, the more helpless I feel. Because it's like, well, if the conspiracy's that big, there's absolutely nothing. Absolutely, you can name anything, and there's nothing you can do against it because the conspiracy is so huge. So you immediately start to think, well, there's really nothing I can do about it but just lose myself in tracking all these conspiracies and be completely inactive and not try to affect any change or whatever. Which, I mean, that the purpose that would serve, of course, would be to cow everybody to
demoralize
keep them from actually trying, demoralize them and keep them from actually acting and trying to have an effect on society or anything, and to take control themselves. So, I mean, ultimately it's a defeatist thing for me. I mean, you go in circles and circles and circles, and eventually you can't resolve anything and you feel helpless, so you do nothing. You know, just keep people twisting around like that. Just keep, you know, keep putting just but enough out there for them to
is it a cause and effect confusion there, though? Because how can you be sure that it's not a feeling of helplessness that is then that you already have, that you already experience, that is shaping the way that you perceive this material?
Possibly, or it could just accentuate a natural helplessness. Everybody has a little bit of weakness now and then, and just accentuates that. And if there is a worldwide conspiracy to make everyone believe there is a worldwide conspiracy, what would be the purpose of that conspiracy if the conspiracy is just to make people think that there is one and that there really isn't one that pervasive and that powerful? Well, the only reason I can think of is to, again, demoralize people and make them feel helpless against a huge conspiracy.
So why would discovering that make you feel helpless and demoralized?
Well, what are you going to do against it? What are you going to do about it? What if all these experiments on children and so forth are actually real or true? There's nothing you can do about it. If it happened to you, there's nothing. How are you going to change it? It's going to happen to another kid. It's happening right now. There's nothing you can do about it. What are you going to do about it?
So is that the only reason to find out about stuff, though, in order to do something about it?
No, not necessarily. I'm just guessing at what would be the, if there was a worldwide conspiracy to make everyone think there was a worldwide conspiracy, why would they be doing that? Well, that's the only thing I can think of. Why, if it's just to make you think there is one, then what other purpose could there be but that? They're not achieving anything by it if their only goal is to make you think that there's a conspiracy.
Well,
but
yes,
they're not actually doing anything. Then,
well, no, but I think that would be going too far, wouldn't that? Because, like, the simplest definition of conspiracy is that individuals with power will pursue their own interests.
Right, yeah, I mean,
which is kind of a no-brainer.
Right,
I
yeah.
Because that's not really to contend there. It's like, if you don't exactly believe that, then you're not
mm-hmm
in touch
yeah
with sort of political realities.
Yeah.
Well, they have shared interests, and so
they have shared interests. That's what I mean. So they would gravitate together in order to pursue those shared
uh-huh
interests together. that's kind of inevitable. But the thing is, you know, does that really involve sacrificing to giant owls or designing the dollar bill or any of this stuff that fascinates people so much? Or is that part of the smokescreen that's being created so that you believe in one conspiracy and then you don't see the conspiracy that really is taking away your power and your freedom and more importantly, shaping your future?
Yeah. Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal. Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal. You read me, Hal? You read me, Hal? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore.
They are here. You have to understand that. They are here.
About 5 years or so ago, my wife Gina and I, we went to a place here in town called Wright Brothers Hill. Now, first I have to give a little bit of background on where I'm at. I am talking from Dayton, Ohio. Dayton, Ohio was the birthplace of the Wright Brothers, and this is where they invented the airplane. And that's the big, you know, birthplace of aviation, Dayton, Ohio. That's the big, you know, everybody learns that and knows that. This is also the location of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which was the home of Project Blue Book, that the Air Force's project of investigating and hopefully debunking any reports of UFO sightings and encounters and so forth and so on. So there's a big Air Force presence here. And, of course, the Wright Brothers Hill would be, it's like a memorial park near the Air Force Base dedicated to the Wright Brothers. And it's on a large hill overlooking one of the landing strips on the in the Air Force base on Wright-Patterson. And you go up there, go to the edge of a wall, and you can look over and, you know, watch planes take off and land and so on and so forth. In the middle of this park, there's a, like I say, a monument that was dedicated to the Wright brothers in the mid to late 40s when Orville Wright was still alive, I believe. And it's just a nice place to go. You go there, it's near the Air Force base, so it's like patrolled, and there's fences where you can't go beyond, but it's an open park, and you know, it's just a nice place to go and sit on a picnic bench and eat a sandwich or whatever. There's also, by the way, Indian mounds up there, very small Indian mounds. And Gina and I, anyways, periodically we'll go up there because early in our relationship we would go up there and just kind of hang out and just sit around and eat sandwiches and talk and sort of, you know, form our relationship, and it's just, you know, a nice place to go. Went there to walk the dogs about approximately 5 years ago, and, you know, fairly nice day. And we were like 2/3 of the way through the walk, kind of making our way back to the car, and a man came up to us. He was taller than me, looked approximately, you know, late 50s, early 60s, I'd say. And he just immediately started telling us about, you know, the history of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and went on and on about how when he was a child, he and his family were part of the early space program and he claimed that there was an area on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where they set up like camps where families would live, and it was basically astronaut training for entire families, because the Air Force or the government, the space program, whatever, however you would want to describe it, at that point felt that that was where we were headed, which was, you know, we're going to, it's a space program, we're going to go into space, we're going to colonize the moon, we're going to move to other planets, and we're going to need to train people how to live in outer space as families, you know, go up, you know, send whole families up. Wow. And he claimed that when he was a child, he was part of this thing, and he grew up, you know, in this outer space camp, and that he was in astronaut training when he was a child. Now, I don't have all the details. It was just kind of a weird sort of encounter at the time. Interesting. I took note of it. I didn't get his name or any contact information. He wasn't giving it out, and I didn't want to, you know, push him, and I didn't know how to, you know, react to this guy who just walked, came up to us and started, you know, talking out of the blue. We were walking our dogs. It's like, and then he went into stories about how post-World War II there was a lot of surplus equipment. I can't remember all the details. I can't remember exactly what he said, but they would have these burn-offs, I think he referred to them as, where they would destroy all this equipment on the base because they had to destroy it because it was, like, surplus, and it, I don't know, for economic reasons, I don't, there, he went off on another tangent is all I'm saying, but, you know, he brought up this astronaut training as a child, and we didn't know whether to believe him or not or whatever, but I've been curious about that ever since. I keep meaning to bring this up, of course, naturally. You know, I tried to research online, and now that you two have heard this little story, maybe if this ends up in the podcast, someone else out there, maybe they know about it, maybe they've done research, maybe they can try to do research and look into this. Whole families, late 50s, mid to late 50s, early 60s, living on the grounds of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base or any other area owned or operated by the Air Force or the government, and families being trained for future space flight and, you know, being sent into space as families and to colonize outer space sort of thing, you know. And I can imagine a lot of these experiments you bring up, Whitley, Stryber, and all these other things, as being in that sort of vein, you know.
Mm-hmm. Have you read The Key? I asked you that already.
No, I have not. I've only read The Communion once when it came out. And, yeah, it was another one of those things that I, you know, I resisted all the way through. And I had already read several books about abduction and, you know, Jung's book and everything. I was already on a wholly psychological sort of interpretation of these things due to my own experiences. So, you know, right. I'm sure a lot of it probably didn't sink in. So I probably will have to do some reading to, you know, actually know the ideas. But is there something in there that I need to know more about? Or?
Oh, and The Key, just that it reminded me, as the Master of The Key mentions to Whitley, that there's a whole population, human populations that have been bred off planet and that live off planet in the solar system somewhere.
Hmm.
And it's one of many outlandish claims in the book, so I don't necessarily put much credence to it,
yeah.
But at the same time, can't be dismissed out of hand either.
Right. It would have, you know, even if the significance is purely on a psychological standpoint, it's not really important whether it's literally true. But yeah, the fact that he would present that idea.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't necessarily want to get sidetracked on the space thing or not, but it is a, and like I, in Lucid View, I wrote a whole chapter about secret space colonization. And, you know, I don't know to what extent I believe these ideas. Very hard for me to say. I know that I just entertained them, and I found them entertaining. But I would certainly, and back then, if you'd asked what my opinion was, it was that, yeah, we already have colonies on the Moon and Mars. That was basically my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, you know, Dave McGowan and others have presented enough evidence to suggest that if we did get to the moon, then the footage we were shown sure wasn't it. And the technology that we were told and shown that was used sure wasn't it either. So I would say either we didn't go to the moon at all because we couldn't, or we did, but why am I saying we? But, you know, humans, they did. But they kept the real means secret.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's one school of thought, which is that with the Van Allen belt, we actually haven't been able to leave the planet at all. And so all of this was just a fabrication to justify all kinds of space programs and all kinds of expenditure, and or give, you know, boost the morale of Western civilization by making us feel like we were conquering new territories. Yeah.
Which would, of course, sort of feed back into this person's story that he told me. You know, they couldn't really, maybe they weren't seriously planning on sending families up, but they wanted people to feel like this was going to be something possible. And why not invest in the space program?
Yeah.
You know, there's like, you know, look at a movie like 2001. It's like, yeah, we're all going to be living in the space wheel to come 2001. I mean, you know, that's where I thought I was going to be living when I was a kid, when I saw 2001, around the time it came out, you know? It's like, wow, man, I'm only going to be like, I'll be only 40, I'll be living in space, and, you know, all this stuff. And it's like, of course, that didn't come to pass, but you believed it, or I believed it. Many of us believed it for a decade or two, you know?
That's interesting, because the technological developments that have been made since then, we couldn't have imagined back then, right?
Right, yeah.
And yet the ones we did imagine, they haven't, like, there's no flying cars, there's no space colonies that we know of, but there's all this other stuff that, okay, some of it's a bit like Star Trek, cell phones they had back in the video screens and all that stuff, but a lot of it, like nanotechnology, genetic modification, you know, the really kind of bizarre stuff is I mean, most people don't even understand it today, never mind back when we were kids.
Yep, exactly.
So it's like there has been a technological revolution, but it hasn't gone in the way that we were all programmed to think it would go.
Yeah. Well, my theory is we do have robots today. It's just that they happen to be very low-paid, illegal immigrant Mexican farm workers. You know, those are our robots. So just a different form of robot, and then we'll soon become like them too. In the Mexicanization, peasantization process currently underway to turn us all into low-wage working slaves.
You know, I've given this a fair amount of thought about my own childhood, and I don't, you know, it's impossible to say whether or not, whether it's just my own personality that was drawn to all these sort of space themes, or what the hell's going on. But when I think back at my childhood, you know, the most important sort of cultural phenomenon was Star Trek, Star Wars, Close Encounters, E.T. I mean, like I said, it could be just that my personality gravitates towards that, or it could be that there's a either conscious or unconscious agenda to promote those ideas.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's pretty empirical. Like, the most famous, most popular TV show ever, Star Trek. Most popular movie ever at the time, Star Wars. Most popular movie ever at the time, E.T.
Yeah.
Right. Are these phenomena a result of just our own human nature, like an organic phenomenon, or not?
Yeah. That would be big question, yeah.
Yeah, but right, with the UFO thing, the answer probably isn't either or. The answer is probably both.
We need answers from you. They're honest, direct, and to the point.
Who are you?
Avez-vous
people?
Fait récemment une rencontre?
Have you recently had a close encounter?
I want to speak to someone in charge.
Une rencontre plutôt inhabituelle.
I want to lodge a complaint.
A close encounter with something very unusual.
What the hell is going on around here? Who the hell are you people?
Who
Well, a close encounter of the first kind is one is close, but nothing really happened.
A close encounter of the first kind is visible contact with UFO.
Forget the shape and forget how fast it's going. It's something that you just can't explain.
Close encounters of the second kind are those which leave a physical trace. Holes in the ground, fern rings, broken tree branches,
telephone lines down,
animals disturbed,
stopping of car engines.
Then the close encounters of the third kind are the most interesting of all.
Close encounter of the third kind is really when you meet them.
There's something real there, like this yearning in us to, like we were talking about fairgrounds last week, and how that those are kind of surrogate experiences for children of, you know, joining the cosmos, of being tapped into the cosmos, with all the spinning wheels and the strange creatures and the flashing lights and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So the same with sci-fi. I mean, 2001 was the, you know, the most the cultural breakthrough of 68 with for the counterculture, and that does. That fuses the space colonization vision to the spiritual realization of enlightenment.
Yeah, it was all very evocative to me. You know, I loved outer space themed things. I was very much drawn intuitively, instinctually, somehow, at least it seemed, anyways, to the whole UFO alien, you know, thing. I loved movies, of course. 2001 was a big, you know, made a big impact on me. I didn't really understand it, but I kind of, sort of, almost did. And, you know, just the visuals enough were a big influence. You know, when we went to the movies as a kid, usually we went to the drive-in, the Belmont drive-in locally. And it, the intermission cartoon that they would show, you know, when it's time for the intermission, go to the snack bar, was an alien landing a flying saucer at the snack bar and, you know, loading up on snacks and getting in his flying saucer and flying off. And when that cartoon came on, I knew I was at the movies and it was another world and I was, you know, escaping to another, you know, greater place, wonderful place. I found that online, I posted it on my Facebook page somewhere out there. It's a cute little cartoon. Keith, you might have watched it. It was after you dumped the whole Facebook thing, Jason. And, you know, my recurring UFO dreams, it's like, well, that was a big, you know, a major part of my development, whatever life experiences, these recurring dreams that went from, I think, early to mid-teens through mid-20s and were very, you know, influential on my life. One thing that I did in all of this was going through some, this was sometime back in the 90s, my mother is after my father died, so we moved in with her to help take care of her. She kind of lived in a bad neighborhood, and the house was falling apart. So we took care of the house and made sure everything was okay and helped, you know, buy the food and pay the mortgage and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, in my constant search going through old things, I came across a book that was put out by, I believe, Life magazine shortly after the Kennedy assassination called, it's like In Remembrance or something about keeping the flame alive. I have it somewhere around here. In fact, I can probably go grab it right now and look at the name of it. I might hear in a second, but flipping through that, and on the inside cover, I found a drawing of an alien that I had drawn in there as a child. And I remembered that I used to, like, you know, trying to draw, I would draw this alien figure inside this book about, you know, Kennedy, remembering Kennedy's legacy after the assassination, sort of thing. So, I mean, that's sort of
Oh, now I get some echoing here.
Yeah, all that right. was not fact.
That's okay. yeah. You know, if you go to the Jungian theory of the flying saucers and, you know, this image of wholeness and, you know, there's... I was probably very unaware of what was going on around the Kennedy assassination, but there was probably a lot of turmoil in the house, emotional, psychological turmoil, you know? And perhaps I picked up on that intuitively, and in response to that, latched on somehow to the alien thing. I don't know if you... But it wasn't a flying saucer that I drew, I believe. It was just an alien. If it was just a round saucer, then I would say, well, it's a mandala image of wholeness, and that was me trying to, respond to this disruptive experience of this, you know, extreme emotional turmoil due to the unexpected assassination of this, you know, this mythic president figure kind of thing. But yeah, I'm just saying, you know, it's obviously something in me. Yeah.
Well, there is a connection though, at least to space, because it was Kennedy who promised that we would land on the moon. Yeah. By the end of the decade.
Exactly.
Right.
So just in the nick of time, it happened.
Yep.
Yeah. And the conspiracy theory that he was assassinated because he wanted to reveal the truth about UFOs.
Yeah, I just came across that recently.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, again, Whitley Strieber's experience is kind of... what's the word? Exemplary, seminal, in that his narrative is a very exact correlation between intolerable circumstances and alien intervention. Like the alien rescues Strieber in his narrative from evil humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of like a microcosmic narrative for the whole collective thing of the benevolent space brothers who come and rescue us from ourselves.
Yeah.
You can see how they superimposed almost exactly. Mm-hmm. So then what you're describing, what all three of us presumably experienced in a more mundane and ordinary fashion, was that we were growing up in a family environment that was less than ideal, that was stressful, that was threatening, that was just painful, and that we looked for ways to escape. And of course, movies, comic books, all the rest, the media themselves are escapism, because they allow us to generate, to enter into fantasy realms. But then the quality of the content of those fantasies, of those media, is also going to be more appealing to us if it's more fantastic, if it's more escapist. So if we're being threatened by humans, by drunken parents or abusive parents or whatever, then the alien just has an inherent appeal because it's not human. It's something different, just as we want to go to another world if this world is unbearable to us.
Yeah, ultimate escape, completely away from everything that could possibly threaten or harm you. I just pulled this book off the shelf. It was called The Torches Past. And it's just like a big picture book of the Kennedy administration and, a couple funeral procession pictures. And in the back cover, there's a very light pencil drawing of a big-headed alien, long neck, bubble helmet, and antennae.
Mm-hmm.
Faint. And then there's a smiling human on the other side. I remember drawing that antennae alien because they all had antennas in them.
Yeah. What's his eyes like?
In a cartoon. Oh, they are not the big eyes. There's like a little dot for the eye, and then a large arc over each one representing eyebrows that's not enclosed, so it's not a complete oval. So it's suggestive of an oval, but it looks more like, you know, like a woman, a crazy lady who shaves her eyebrows off and draws them on kind of eyebrows. And there's no mouth or anything, just eyes. Round head, eyes, antennae, bubble helmet, which is a horrible drawing, by the way. So I must have been very young at the time.
Do you remember drawing it?
I remember drawing that type of alien, but not in that book exactly. But I'm sure I just... It's a large book. It's like... It's bigger than 8.5 by 11. It's like probably... It's not 11 by 17. I'd say it's probably 10 by 12 inches or larger. And it's just a large white space to draw on. So it would I imagine, be very inviting to a kid with a pencil.
So what do you think about the idea that that alien is a self-portrait?
I don't know. Maybe the smiling face on the other side is the self-portrait, and that's me meeting the alien. I don't know. Because when you... It's on one side is the alien, and on the other side is the humanoid-looking person. Looks like he has two buttons on his... It looks... neck, but I'm sure it's supposed to be a collar or something. But and when you close them, they both meet together, of course. So I don't know.
So then there'd be both you. There'd be two sides.
Possibly. Yeah. Possibly.
Split in two.
Yeah.
Maybe the smiley face, I'm freely interpreting here because you're not in therapy right now. Maybe the smiley face was the face you had to put on, the human child, your parents, and the alien self was the real self, how you really felt, and you didn't draw a mouse on it because you couldn't express that side of you.
Yeah, sure. Let's go with that. You know, it could be, well, not, I don't know, alternative theory, but what was it, 11/22/63. So I was, what, 2-3 years old, you know, probably when the book came out. The book was after everything was said and done, so it might have been 6 months to a year after that. So let me see if I can get an exact date, because we probably got it immediately. Go ahead.
Yeah, passed on to them.
Do what?
It says the torch passed on.
Yeah, it says the torch is passed.
To what? To who?
Right, exactly. I don't know. To Lyndon Johnson, I suppose. To us Americans. Well, it says... it just says who owns the copyright, not a date. So I don't know the date, but I'm assuming it's 6 months to a year after. It's probably something Life magazine offered, I believe. And I've seen it other places. It's a book that you can find occasionally in thrift stores and here in the U.S. of A. Not really worth anything.
Well, you know, about Kennedy, one of the things that seems obvious to me about why he's considered to be this great martyr is the fact that he did die. I mean, obviously he can't be a martyr if he didn't die, but I mean, you can't idealize somebody if they live on to disappoint you, right? Because then you actually see what they're really going to do. The fact that he died when he was still, you know, peaking, nearing the crest, and he was filling everyone with hope, he never had a chance to betray those promises that he made.
Yeah.
So he remained this kind of shining ideal.
Yeah, which was preserved, of course, when the whoever it was, CIA, FBI, not bumped Marilyn off. To protect that Kennedy. Wonderful...
the Kennedys who killed Marilyn.
Well, yeah, through their agencies there.
I was thinking Bobby of James Kennedy. Dean as a correlate to
Kennedy. James Dean's obvious, yeah. He never got old. But anyway, I just didn't want to sidetrack too much, but I was thinking how that also correlates with the space thing in a way, because it's the grass is always greener thing. As long as you can project onto what's distant your own fantasies, of course it will seem like a better world. And as long as you're not happy with the world you're in, rather than try and actually make it work or address what's wrong with it, the natural tendency is, because it's so much easier, is to go off into fantasy, but fantasies that you can tell yourself are real. So that's movies, but then that's also the whole idea of space, like colonizing space and creating a new world. Space is like almost literally space, this blank.
That's the final frontier.
Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah. I mean, this is a question that's come to me, and it never came to me before. Why the hell would we want to colonize space?
Right, exactly. Well, you know, it's like dissociation from the body. The Earth is the body. You can't live without the Earth. You know, it's like that just speaks of dissociation right there, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's going to be better out there. What do you mean better out there? It's like just totally destroy this planet that we live on, you know, and go find another planet. It's like, well, we're on a planet, you know? We don't give a shit about this planet. Why do we need another fucking planet? You know, they're all big, lifeless rocks and inhospitable. Why do we want to go out there? Well, we kind of don't anymore. I think it's kind of pretty much obvious that there's nowhere to go. Not even the moon, really. I did have a really interesting dream a couple years ago about the moon, where I looked up at the moon, and it's like, you know, that line we brought, Star Wars, I'll bring it up, you know, that's no moon, it's a space station. It's, wait a minute, that's not the moon's surface, that's all artificial. And I realized that the Chinese had completely settled the moon, and they built, like, an artificial shell around the moon. And then, you know, so I looked up, so the moon was now looked like the Death Star from Star Wars. And then, once I realized that, I realized I was on a spaceship headed to the moon for the World Championship basketball tournament, which was hosted by the Chinese, who had all genetically engineered themselves to all be now tall instead of short. And it was like America versus China, and the American team was all black, and then the Chinese were, of course, all Chinese.
Right. And so if that was Whitley, that he would be presenting that as having remote viewed the future.
Right, exactly. To me, it was just a weird, funny dream. But yeah, maybe it was the future. I mean, yeah. If anybody's going to colonize the moon, it will be the Chinese.
こんな独裁者に癒しめられるのは悲しい。